Welcome to the Junior Golf Blueprint, episode 49, presented by Matt Walter, PGA Teacher Professional. Today's podcast, ladies and gentlemen, I had the opportunity to bring on Maurice Allen, the 2018 World Long Drive Champion. We had a fantastic discussion talking about all ranges of things, of how he got into long drive competition, to the things he's doing off the golf course to better society. He is a well-rounded, a very grounded individual as well. He just brings a lot of great benefits to the game of golf, and he's going to do a fantastic job of growing his sport of long drive competition. Without a shadow of a doubt, he's going to do great things for it. And I really enjoyed the chat we had. I think you will too. There's a lot of things in there that I think will help inspire you to be a better person, as well as better yourself at the things you want to be elite at, and you know, the things that we have a passion for. He really has some great nuggets in there to drive you to become better at your passion. So, without holding you up any longer, I want you guys to listen in on this podcast and take away some great nuggets that he dropped for us.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, so today on the podcast, we have the one and only Nature Boy, world champ, Maurice Allen. He is the 2018 RE/MAX World Long Drive champ. He is a beast that has pumped 1.393 to win the current world drive title, long drive title. Maurice, thank you for coming on the podcast, and I appreciate your time and willingness to do this. If you would, tell everybody a little bit about yourself and how you came into this game of golf.
I'm about to say, you just did it, so there it is. But thank you for having me on. I got into the game of golf, I guess. My dad tried to introduce me as a kid, and this was, you know, mid-late 80s, and obviously it was pre-Nike, pre-Tiger, pre-anything like that, so golf was just never a cool sport. I never played it growing up, didn't do junior golf, didn't do college, high school, none of that, because it just wasn't cool. I was probably a 5 or 6 sport athlete growing up, and came back around to golf right as I was graduating from college. Hanging out with some of my friends and some of my cousins, broke one of their clubs, took it to a golf, et cetera. I was like, hey man, can you fix this club, blah, blah, blah. And the guy said, oh, this is an old set. You know, he's like, well, how far do you hit a 7-iron? And I told him I hit a 7-iron. I was like, I don't know, probably 230 or something like that. And he looked at me and was like, all right, yeah, right. How far do you really hit? I was like, and I didn't understand how significant the 230 was. But I hit it on the simulator and went 235 to 240 on the simulator. He was like, man, you need to try this long drive thing out, I promise you. And it kind of went from there. And I think the big thing of it that made it go full circle was today I was at Aronimink, and that guy is Steve Harrison. He works with Bryson DeChambeau. He's a part of the Sick Putter. He's the CEO of Sick Putters. Right. And today I was at Aronimink, and I hadn't seen Steve in a long time, and I was actually able to take him the belt right there inside the rope on the range at Aronimink, and it was a nice reaction to see him just kind of buckle to the floor right there on the range with all these, you know, the heavy hitters were there, Tiger Woods, Brooks Koepka, all these guys were right there, and it was like he was the happiest kid alive, didn't care that Bryson had just won 2 in a row. Like, to him, that belt was probably his biggest accomplishment ever.
Man, that is awesome. You're in my neck of the woods, gang. I grew up just outside of Philadelphia and worked at a course just down the road from Aronimink. I had to drive by Aronimink every day for an internship. That's crazy how you got a start into that. That's just wild. That, and I could tell you this right now, as a former like assistant professional working in the club and now as a teaching pro, I get plenty of people that walk in the door telling me how far they hit it, and I'm guilty of the eye roll for sure. So I can't say I've been any better.
Oh, yeah, man. I mean, I didn't know how significant it was. I didn't play golf, so I mean, even in the beginning of this whole process, I used to always think, well, anybody can hit the ball long. It doesn't take much, you know. All you got to do is swing at it, because that's how simple it was for me. And I guess at probably one of the biggest growing points of my career was when I had no money. I was sleeping in my car. I ended up getting a job at the PGA Tour Superstore, being a fitter. And I had these guys they'd say all kinds of stuff to me about, oh, I can hit the ball this, I can do that, I can do this. I was like, okay. And then they wouldn't do it. And I'm like, you know, I'm about to put you on a simulator. So whatever you tell me, I mean, I'll see it here literally in 30 seconds. So I don't know why you feel the need to lie to me about it. And, oh, your simulator must be broken. I was like, really? Let me grab a 9-iron real quick. Should go about 180 yards, 190. Pop it at 180, 190 on the sim. I said, nope, still good. Sorry. See, it was not the machine. So, but it was, it's definitely something I still think to this day, I still don't truly get it, but it's cool. It's cool.
Oh, yeah, man. Well, it's, you know, it's funny because I think, you know, because I teach golf for a living, and yeah, I think a lot of it has to do with, you know, golf is a sport where it's not, you're not reacting necessarily to something coming at you like a baseball or basketball or football. You're like, ball is just sitting there. And so you have to create some form of a process in your head that creates an athletic motion. And for some people, trying to do that is enough to bog down a brain enough to not be an athlete.
Yeah, you know, for me, I didn't take the conventional view towards the golf swing or towards getting into the ball. I actually watched films of David Ortiz and Albert Pujols to really model my golf swing.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's not bad. How'd you take a track start? You know, as a, you know, that was, I remember you saying that's kind of where your roots come from. How did you translate some of the stuff you've learned from track to your golf swing?
I wouldn't say more so into the golf swing. I would say the work ethic. So to run track, you have to be borderline crazy. It's one of the few sports where it's self-inflicted pain. Because when you're out there training every day, the person who's literally going to make you throw up, pass out, fall out is you. I mean, you can tell your legs to stop running. You can say, oh, I don't want to do this. But you really have to psych yourself up every day that you're going to practice to understand that you're going to push your body past or to a level of just pure exhaustion. And I think that that mindset and that viewpoint was probably the biggest thing to help me, because remember, when I first started, I didn't have any golf experience. So going to the range for 14 hours, 16 hours, hitting 1,000 balls, 1,500, even 2,000 golf balls a day at some point till my hands would bleed. That is something that I had to do mentally. I had to be able to prepare, because I had to, my coach believed that what someone does in a week, the amount of balls someone hits in a week, I had to learn to hit that in a day and then come back and repeat it day in, day out. It wasn't, I'm tired, I'm sore, I have calluses, my hands are bleeding, learn to put tape on. Then I went from golf gloves are too thin to putting on football gloves, and we're still going to get the swings in. I'm wearing my grips out, I'm breaking club heads, I'm breaking shafts. Doesn't matter. Have to get the swings in, because there's an amount of experience and knowledge that you can only get out of the dirt. And that's one of those things I just had to do.
Man, I'm so glad you have said that on this podcast, because I've preached it before time and again when I've done some solo episodes. And to hear it from a world champ, that the work ethic that's required to get there, yeah, it's tough. You know, we live in a world of instant gratification now, where knowledge is at your fingertips and answers are right there. It's, you know, it's sometimes it's hard for kids to look at it in a long-term goal as far as where they're trying to be versus where they are now. And so just to kind of say that, you know, the effort that was required to get to where you are, I mean, that is phenomenal work ethic there. And I've only heard of maybe two other people I know that have put in that much range ball sessions. One of them's a mentor. that's a lot of golf ball, sir. And then go ahead.
I was going to say the big thing about it is if you want something, and let's take it past golf, because a lot of people just look at golf, golf, golf. Well, you know, you hear people all the time say, oh, well, I don't like school. Okay, well, what is it that you want to do? And it doesn't matter if it's a tattoo artist. It doesn't matter if it's some sort of a musical artist or musician of any sort. Or if you want to be someone who's in some sort of a trade, if it's a web design, it doesn't matter. All the way through in any profession, the single most thing that you can't cheat, the single most thing that you can't undermine is experience. You know, when you look at Ray Lewis, or let's look at, I mean, I know you're from Philly, but let's look at Tom Brady. That's probably the best example alive. One of the best quarterbacks to have ever played the game. He continues to evolve. Who he was when he stepped in for Bledsoe versus who he is now, obviously through age, he's not getting any faster, but it seems as though he's playing better. If you don't like looking at him, let's look at Peyton Manning in his final season. You know, they said, oh, he had the worst numbers alive, but one thing you could not deny was the experience. He had seen everything there was to see. And even if his incompletion ratio or whatever it was just wasn't great, his experience was things that he was able to literally play off of, because he had seen every coverage you could think of. He had seen every scenario you could think of. They know that, okay, it's a 2-minute drill and the game's on the line. Both of them are like, been there, done that. I can run down this field because I've done it a million times. Not only have I done it, you know, hundreds of times in actual game situation, but I've literally prepared myself over and over and over again. And that's the big difference between, in golf, the pros and the people who are not pros. You know, you look at Brooks Koepka, every time he's in a power situation, or Tiger, or even Adam Scott, if you're looking at this PGA championship that just went by, these guys aren't seeing those shots for the first time. A lot of times we have amateurs who are looking at stuff and for the first time, and they're expecting a miracle. These guys practice the absolute impossible, the shot that they say, oh, well, I may only get this one out of 10,000 times, because that one out of 10,000 is probably going to be the time when they have to pull it off and it's going to mean the most. My last shot at World Championships, you know, everybody's like, oh, man, that last shot, you crushed it, you did. And I was like, yeah, but I looked at the clock and I remember my dad telling me right before I got to the range, he said, hey, yesterday you looked rushed. Slow yourself down. You got plenty of time. And that's exactly what I heard right before I stepped up to that ball. And that's why I backed off of it. And I looked at the clock and I saw I had 30-some seconds. I was like, hey, kid, just calm down, relax. Don't try to kill it, because most people say, oh, you tried to kill it. No, I didn't. What I told myself was, there's two things. You know, on the takeaway, don't take it too far inside. Get on your left side and push the knee. Those were the three things I thought about. It turned out to be a miraculous shot, but I focused on the process rather than the result, and that's how I was able to get that done.
Man, and that is, man, you're preaching some knowledge there. And I'll tell you this, the grin on your face when you turned around back to the camera after you smacked that thing, I saw the fact that that was a guy that stood up there knowing he was already going to do that. You know, I've seen those looks before, and I'm like, that he knew that was coming. He felt that one before he hit it. I love that you just said there about the preparation. I mean, you know, a lot of people like to hear the story about luck, you know, and how luck plays a factor into, how where people have gotten, you know, I just don't believe in it. I believe luck is, you know, when preparation meets opportunity. And when you've prepared enough and the opportunity is presented for you and you're prepared for that opportunity, then that's what people look at as, oh, they're so lucky. And then you don't see what's underneath an iceberg, where everybody sees the tip of the iceberg sitting above water, but you don't see the massive amount of ice and effort that's sitting underneath the ocean. It's the same kind of concept. I mean, so much effort has to go in to perform at a pinnacle. And what most people see is just this athlete or competitor at the top, and how glorious it must be to run a 40 at 4.2 seconds and, you know, jump 4 feet off the ground and all this other crazy stuff. And, you know, at the same time, it's like, you just don't wake up and do that. It takes time.
Yeah. I mean, I'll be honest with you. I don't believe in luck at all. Not in the least bit. I believe in nothing but destiny, with absolutely no disrespect at all to any of my competitors or anybody who I faced throughout that tournament. I'm a firm believer that it was something that I saw in my dreams. It's something that I believe God had in store for me, because it was more about having a champion who could take the sport to the next level. I honestly and truly believe without that, I never would have won. So winning, I honestly do not see it as a selfish goal that was accomplished. I look at it more like a job of service. And now I have a minimum of 150 brothers that I am responsible to make sure that they eat. I am responsible to make sure that they are given the respect that they deserve in this sport, because up to this point, that has not happened. So I really, you know, everybody's like, oh man, you must be on a high. This is great. How does it feel? I was like, honestly, it feels like I got a lot of work to do. I have a lot of people counting on me. There are a lot of people who are expecting me to do the right thing. And I think that's the only reason why I was placed in this position. There was never a time on Wednesday night when I hit a ball that I was like, I am worried if this is going to get me through to the next round. And it had nothing to do with being, oh, well, I smashed the competition, nobody can get close to me. It wasn't that. It was more so of an understanding of saying, hey, I'm here for a reason. God wants me to win this for a reason. So I'm literally walking in the shoes of my destiny. On Tuesday night, when I went up against Brian Kelly, I kind of lost my faith. I looked around, I told my mom, I said, oh, Ma, this isn't going to make it. This isn't going to make it. You know, 82 is just not enough. It's not long enough. And she looked at me and she's like, don't you ever, ever in your life, you know, decide for God. God's going to do what he's supposed to do. And did he tell you that you were going to win this tournament? And no lie, on Saturday, I saw it in my dreams. Before I left the house on Wednesday, I saw it, even to the point of what I was going to wear each and every day. And walking through that tunnel that we walked through, and we had to walk through it, let's see, 5 times on Saturday, 4 times on Sunday, I was able to visualize myself on a banner with a pink shirt, some khaki-ish pants, and the shoes I had that were like a confetti-type shoe with a khaki background, holding up a belt. And I saw it, and I saw it every day walking through the tunnel. And then when I didn't hit the ball that I thought was a great swing, and it was 82, the first thing I did was totally lose the faith that I had all week. And even before I got on the plane to go, and I remember when I won, everybody was like, oh man, great job, you made it. And I honestly had this sick feeling. I had like this pit in the bottom of my stomach, like somebody just kicked me in my stomach, because it was more of a disappointing fact that I had literally lost faith when I knew better. I should have always known that when God tells you he's going to do something, that's exactly what's going to happen. Don't you ever question it. But I questioned it. So I walked around for 4 or 5 hours in the worst funk of my life. And I think God saw that and said, wow, you know, he actually really believes in me. And he's heartbroken at the fact that when he had the opportunity to really believe in me, he didn't. He just didn't believe. And I had to pray about it. And then the next day, everybody says, you had this confidence that something was different. And it was like, yeah, because I had lost my faith the day before. And I had to have a serious reality check. And it was something bigger than long drive. And that was the difference the next day.
Man, that's some great insight. Because it's, one, it's always nice to have strong parents in your background, too, that help remind us to stay on the right track and to stay focused and to, you know, to believe in yourself and the process and the powers to be to get you to where you dreamed of being. But you know, I think what you're mentioning there is just an excellent case of what, you know, a strong competitor can do when he knows that the moment is bigger than what just having his name written on a belt or name being put before, you know, hundreds of thousands of people as the world champion. You know, there's a higher purpose for that. And when you can see that there's more to the situation than just what you're doing right then and there, that's when the moment's the most surreal, I think.
100%. 100%. I don't think that I'm that great of a hitter. I just think that maybe I'm the person who can elevate the sport at this particular moment. And if I do that, then maybe it's meant for me to have more world titles. Honestly, I don't know. I know that my job right now is to put the sport in the forefront, to raise the professionalism. And hopefully by doing that, it'll raise the possibility of sponsorships so that a lot of these guys can go out there and make a living, because long drive is tough. It's no different than mini tour golf. There, people look at it and say, oh man, you won 125K. And I'm like, yeah, but there are a lot of people who, there's nobody else in the sport this year who could have even won that amount of money. And they spend a lot of money, and there just needs to be a lot of things that are fixed from the corporate side. I mean, what Golf Channel was doing, I have zero problems with that. That is amazing. I mean, we had 5 events on TV this year. So yeah, now it's time for the hitters to step up and say, you know something, we're going to conduct ourselves in a certain way. We're not going to be looked at as Neanderthals or the golf ball whacker guy or whatever it is, Happy Gilmore. We're actually going to take ourselves serious. We're going to conduct ourselves like touring pros, and we're going to expect the pay of touring pros as well.
Yeah, man, look, I preach, brother. I get it. I mean, it's one of those things that I think long drive is going to be gaining a lot of traction here in the very near future, because, you know, one of the biggest, you know, knocks against golf is the time it takes to play 18 holes. And Lord knows the PGA Tour isn't very fast in an 18-hole round. So there's not as much excitement. I mean, like, y'all get the crowds all juiced up. They're pumped. They're hollering. They're screaming. You guys are, you know, in my opinion, the greatest showmans in golf that you can have, because race the arena. You know, it's like you guys are two gladiators going in there and duking it out. It's head to head. You know, I kind of think that's why there's so much talk about this Tiger Phil thing coming up after Thanksgiving. It's because there's hardly any, you know, head to head kind of, I'm calling you out, this is me against you. And you know, I think it's just an interesting dynamic that golf doesn't get. I think that's all. I also think that's why Topgolf has taken off. You know, it's this different twist to a sport that is bringing in the market that it doesn't acquire, which is the millennial market. You know, people that's kind of in my bracket, the 30-somethings, you know, that are kind of, you know, they got a couple kids, they don't really have a lot of time, they want to pick up the sport, but there's a cost behind it. So I think it's leading in a direction between what you guys are doing and what Topgolf is doing, that I think we're going to see a cataclysmic change in golf over the next 10 years.
Yeah, definitely, you know, because of the fact that like you said before, we're at an instant gratification society. The game of golf is almost just too long. It does not have the patience for the game of golf. It just doesn't. So what does long drive bring you? It brings you across between home run derby and the slam dunk contest on the tee box. You know, it's a combination of all those things, and it gets the excitement, and does it take a lot of patience or attention span? It's 3 minutes, so people are really going to get amped up for it, and then they can pick and choose. And it's like you said, the gladiators right there in the Coliseum, because when you get to the end of a long drive event, it's match play. It's mano a mano. You pick your favorite, and, you know, and two guys go slug it out, and they go to battle, and that's closer to what you see in Topgolf. You can call people out. You're going head-to-head, and nobody else. That is just an interesting concept that is starting to, I guess, really shape what's going on. You know, you look at golf changing as a whole, with music being involved and the speakers and all the other stuff, and you see that all in long drive. And I hope that that's something people can relate to, and it helps it grow.
Yeah, man, I think so. I think it's going to be fun. So let me ask you some technical kind of questions about the differences in long drive. I don't think many people realize the drivers that you guys are using are it's not an 8.5 degree, you know, standard issue stiff flex driver. And on top of that, you can probably only get maybe what, almost a dozen hits before you almost crack a face open. So tell me a little bit about the equipment side, because it has my kind of curiosity, and I've talked to a few other people before we chat tonight. And, you know, that seems to be one of the main questions people have are, you know, what are these guys swinging that they can swing at 140 miles an hour and still connect on the golf ball?
So let's go on the equipment side. First and foremost, everybody has to understand everything that you see in world long drive or pretty much any of the long drive all over the globe, it has to be USGA and RNA conforming. That's length, that's heads, that's everything. There is nothing out there where it's an illegal driver. Those days and that myth are so old school, so long. I know at one point in long drive, it was from what I've been told, it was if you could swing it, you could hit it. Those days are long over. It literally has to be, if you can't play with it on the tour, you can't use it. So we need to go ahead and deaden that thought and that misconception early. Now, on the equipment side, yeah, it is definitely different on the loft. And that's mainly because you're looking at spin and you're looking at ball apex. Me personally, right now, let's look at CPMs. The CPM clubs that I was using, the winning club I had was a 2-degree crank F6 head with a 293 CPM flex at 47 inches. So I don't know. I think that's a 4.5, maybe a 5X when you look at it that way.
And, for people that don't know what CPM, that cycles per minute. So when they test the flex of the shaft, how fast is it quivering on a machine?
Yeah, we don't really focus on 1X, 2X, 3X. We really focus on CPMs for those people out there wondering. You can have a 1X and it ranges. I think the range is like 10 cycles. Well, in our world, 10 cycles could mean a million different things. So we really go within a 3 to 5 cycle. Most of the clubs that I had in this last event ranged anywhere from 283 to 295. So that could be anywhere between a 3.5 to a 4.5 or a 4 to a 5X. All my drivers ranged anywhere from 1.5 all the way up to 3 degrees.
So how are you making decisions on what to put in play when you're competing out there on the circuit and the conditions are changing? Like, you have elevation differences, you got wind differences, maybe it dumped 2 inches of rain the night before and you know you're gonna be relying on carry, not roll out. So how are you making game day decisions?
So I have a great club builder. His name's Jack Adams. He lives in Kennesaw, Georgia at the PGA Tour Superstore. Then I also use the guy Trevor, who is right there on the road with us as a touring van club fitter. Just in case if stuff goes wrong, I had a few heads kind of come loose, you know, the epoxy separated from the ferrule. But you definitely build your stuff up where it's, I have some clubs where it's tipped 2 inches, some where it's tipped 1 inch, some stuff where it's blind bore or shadow board and all this other stuff. So, you know, some stuff that's set up for a fade, some things that are set up for a draw, and you're really paying attention to the conditions you're seeing. For instance, it's an all carry grid. The first night it was a little weird because it was an all carry grid and the wind was in your face. Good luck with that. So you have to hit like this flat, boring trajectory. It can't be too low because obviously you're not going to get enough carry, but it can't be too high. When we were hitting in the finals, it started to rain. So you're trying to find something where you can throw it up in the air and counteract or counterbalance the raindrops beating the ball down. But you have to throw it up and it can't have too much spin. And that's where we talked about earlier about the experience and having that experience from playing and seeing and hitting so many balls and getting it out of the dirt. And you just got to know what you believe is your, you know, your stick. What are you really, really trying to go after?
Man, I hear you. And, you know, and that's stuff that, you know, we can even apply as, you know, just, you know, the kids out there that are just playing normal junior golf tournaments, right? You're going to have bad weather days. Some days are going to be really hot. Some days are going to be really windy. And to your point, you know, it's almost tough to say to go out and practice in the rain because it's not a lot of fun. You don't want to do it. And you're going to come home soaking wet and cold and need nothing more than a hot shower. But at the end of the day, like you said, the experience is what's going to carry you through. So if you only practice in perfect conditions and you've never gone out and played 18 holes and they're soaking rain with the, you know, torrential downpours, or if you never play when it's super windy because it's not as much fun, then you get that in a tournament and you don't know how to react, and it could be to the detriment. So I think the experience that you're explaining here with how it relates to your world long drive competitions, I mean, it carries across, you know, in just not just golf, but in everything, honestly. But for the kids out there listening, you know, it's how you can take it from, you know, playing pretty good during, you know, normal conditions and keeping that level of quality golf while the conditions have worsened.
Yeah. So for me, a big thing that I consistently do is I like to practice into the wind. I remember when I first started, everybody would practice downwind because they were like, oh, look how far I'm hitting the ball. Look how far I'm hitting the ball. And I remember saying, well, how far you hit it in practice doesn't even matter. I mean, anybody can hit the ball downwind, but what you're looking for is a pure ball flight. And that's the difference between the top 30 guys in the world and everybody else, or even the top 50. Those guys know how to flight the ball. They're not just going based on distance. They're really paying attention to the conditions. And in order to win a world long drive event, whether it be a tour event or world championships, there's no way that you can just have one swing, one ball flight, one move. It ain't going to happen because something's going to happen as fast as you're swinging. The timing is going to get off, or you're going to have to, you know, really pay attention to the conditions. Something's going to happen where you have to be able to adjust. And that is one of the big reasons why I practice into the wind, because into the wind, it tells you the truth. There are a lot of guys out there who use flight scopes and track mans and everything under the sun like that. And no disrespect to those, but one thing you can't cheat is the wind. The wind will always tell you the truth. So I make sure that I practice into the wind because I want to see what's going to happen when tough conditions come down.
Man, me and you are a lot alike, I think. Because that's exactly how I felt whenever I prep for my tournaments. It's, you know, I much rather beat balls into the wind and know, you know, that little extra curvature that's going to get exaggerated. I know if I can go out there and hit rope straight ball or very little movement with my golf ball while I'm, you know, practicing into the wind, then I know I'm pure in it. I'm hitting it solid. But downwind makes everything go straight and, like you said, long. So it doesn't really help you. It gives you a false confidence in your ability. I'm fortunate where I teach golf now, you know, 9 out of 10 days I teach, it's into the wind. And some days it's exemplified with a left or right wind. So, you know, the average Joe golfer I teach that already hits a banana slice, if I can get him to turn one into the wind, he kind of looks back at me and I'm like, hey, man, if you can keep it straight in that wind, you're doing pretty good.
Exactly.
So moving on, I have a question for you about I had a couple people ask me, because, you know, obviously who's better to ask about how to gain some yardage than somebody that can hit it 400 yards. What are some tips that, you know, you may have for the average golfer when it comes to gaining a little extra club head speed and a little bit of distance off the tee ball?
You know, the first thing I would say is learn your swing. A lot of times we spend too much time trying to recreate or emulate someone else rather than just doing what we do. You know, guys look at Rory, or, I mean, after being on the range today and literally seeing all these guys, if you don't have the body types of Brooks Koepka, don't pay attention to what Brooks Koepka does. if you don't have the background of Dustin Johnson, then don't try to do what Dustin Johnson does. That's not how that works. That is an impossible thing for you to do. If you're not 6'5" and, you know, can dunk a basketball and all this other stuff, why are you trying to make moves that someone who can does? But spend some time learning yourself. Figure out your strengths. If you're a person who has, you know, great balance or strong legs, then learn to incorporate your legs into your swing. If you're a person who has a, you know, fast hands, if you play baseball, learn to use that to your strength and to your advantage and how to gain some distance. There's so many different ways to gain distance. I mean, yes, ultimately it does come down to club head speed and, or rephrase, ball speed and spin. And club head speed just tells you what you're capable of doing, but solid contact will always give you a better ball speed. So watch your contact into the ball. Make sure you're hitting it, you're striking it well, you're not hitting down on it. But really use the tools that you have to incorporate those into your swing and turn them into positives, and then therefore you'll gain some distance.
Man, I wish we had done this in a video conference, because you'd just see my hands like going up in the air saying thank you for somebody else preaching center contact for more distance.
I'm not being funny, but let's look at my swing. Let's take my whole swing. You know, the ball's outside my left foot, the club head's a foot and a half to 2 feet behind the ball. I've got like this Charles Barkley stutter. I'm on my toes. Who are you going to go teach that to? I'll wait. It's never going to happen. So man, why would someone, as ridiculous as it sounds, to try to mimic my swing and get distance, is just as ridiculous to try to mimic Bubba or Tiger or Phil or any of them.
I have a member at the club I teach, and I teach his daughter. And he's actually this year's club champion, and he's taken a few rounds well below sub 70. And you watch him swing a golf club, and we have a phrase for it. We call it unclassically trained, because you know, when you watch it move, you're like, oh, God, I can't watch this. And then you look at the scorecard, and he just smoked you by five. You're like, all right, Phillip's got it today.
Exactly.
But I think I like most about that point is – The junior golf world, you know, it's an interesting dynamic in the sense that, you know, parents who maybe have played or know the game a little bit, and they watched a lot of PGA Tour golf, and then they see their kids doing some funky little hitch in their swing or whatever, and so then I get the phone call, and you know, sometimes I blow some parents' minds and I say, hey, that funky little hitch you're seeing isn't really as big a deal as you think. And when your kid's only 9 years old, I'm like, let's go ahead and just worry more about how they're going to put the ball in the cup versus, you know, making them look like Tiger Woods from 2001. I think the points you're making there about, you know, owning your swing and knowing where your strengths are and doing your own thing are great, because as a coach, I've taught some players that, you know, they just befuddle me, because they'll go out and they'll get the text messages before on the range, I'm hitting it terrible, I can't figure it out. And then they go out and shoot like 71, 68, or something like that. And then I'll have the similar text messages from other players that I'm striping it, this is going to be a good day. And they come in with like 82. I think it's funny how there's a mindset with it almost as well, there it's, if you can train kids to not necessarily worry about what their swing looks like, but more worry about what the ultimate objective of playing a tournament round of golf is, and that's to shoot the lowest score, then the mechanics kind of go away, and the kids can almost learn a golf swing that suits them more easily.
Yeah, most definitely. I mean, the beautiful thing about being a kid is you have not been jaded by life, and you haven't been cursed by conformity, and you have this thing called an imagination, and it's the most beautiful and purest thing out there in the world. And if you can find a way to keep that, especially in this game of golf, you can become unstoppable. because you have, with imagination, you have no limits. And that's what, if you look at a Jim Furyk, no one's going to go out there and try to recreate that swing. Or if you look at Tiger with some of the stuff he pulls off, it's just like, he's like, hey, yeah, there's a window there. And people look at it like, what window? He's like, yeah, there's about a 2 foot window. And to the average person, 2 feet is not a window.
Yeah.
Like, I can't even see that 2 foot gap that you're talking about because it's not a gap. But in his imagination, he says that's a window. And he can see that. And that's what allows him to pull it off because he can. One of my favorite movies ever, still to this day, is 7 Days in Utopia. How he made him paint the picture of, you know, the shot. He made him meditate on it first. And then hit around the tree, and he turned around and hit it. You know, the whole see it, feel it, trust it. And that's what you need, not only in golf, but in life. If you're going to make a mistake or if you're going to make a decision, you can't be afraid of the negative outcome. You have to go into it wholeheartedly, 100%, and understand, okay, well, if I make a mistake or if it doesn't turn out the way I want to, there's still something to be learned in this, but I still have to go after it 100%. I have to really be in tune with the moment when I make this decision. I need to have a clear head. I need to really, truly commit. And conviction and commitment are two things that people in life as a whole, not just in golf, are seriously lacking. Because when you teeter back and forth, I guarantee you, you're going to mess up. If you commit 100% and you have conviction in your belief of that, then you have a better chance of pulling it off.
Man, I hear you. And it, you know, it's funny. My wife played college golf, and that see, feel, trust was, that's what got her through 5 years of playing college golf, was that mantra. yeah. And I had a question on here for you about, you know, advice for kids to play competitive golf. But I feel like at this point, you've laid so many golden nuggets. I don't even know if the question's even.
I've got a perfect answer for that question.
Bring
golf
it.
Golf is just like life. You don't intend to hit the ball out of bounds or in the water, but it will happen sometimes. And understand that when it happens, it is meant for you. It's a lesson meant for you to learn out of that. It doesn't even necessarily mean that you did something wrong. You could hit the ball in the middle of the fairway, and it could take a bounce off of a sprinkler head or a marker and go out of bounds. And understand that just because you get a bad result doesn't mean that your process was bad, just like in life. Sometimes you have to just accept the bad shots. Sometimes you have to accept the bad news. And the key to being a successful person in life and the key to being a successful golfer is you can't allow when something doesn't go your way for you to get bent out of shape. You need to find a way to enjoy the bad rounds of golf, the bad days in life, because when you learn to truly enjoy and be thankful for the bad things that happen, when the good things happen, they'll be even more precious.
Man, yes, 100%. I mean, I think you have highlighted a great point there, and I think not just the kids walking away with it, but the parents too, because, you know, I think the hardest thing to do, I didn't really get a chance to experience this since I started doing a PGA Junior League. The hardest thing to do is watch your child or a kid play a round of golf by themselves, and you can't help. You have to kind of let them make their own decisions, and sometimes you want to beat your head against the wall because they're making the wrong ones, but you can't say it or show that kind of emotion. You have to be very supportive, and the thing you have to remember as a parent watching your kid is that nobody wants to fail. Nobody intends to fail, and if they mishit a shot or if they, you know, misplay the shot, their intent was good. You know, it's just sometimes the rub of the green doesn't go your way.
Well, but let's look backwards. What is failure? And I think in society we have a true misconception of failure. What because you didn't win the tournament, you failed? No, because you didn't because you didn't make a 15-foot putt, you failed. Really? Mathematically, the chances of you making that putt are 13% on the PGA Tour.
Yeah, that's
a good let's, you know what I mean? So let's really try to come to an understanding of what is failure. You know, when I look at a kid who misses an 18-footer for par and they slap their leg and they're pissed off, you know, I'm like, why? Did you even understand the mathematics on how small your percentages were to make that putt? Let's go backwards. Instead of looking at the result, let's look at the process. Where did you mess up? Where you left yourself 18 feet? Because that's the real problem. And it's just like in life, you know, oh, well, you're mad that you got, you know, you got pulled over by the cops, or you're in jail, or you got a bad grade, final grade. Well, there was something you did along the way that got you to that point. So let's fix that rather than being mad at someone else for what the end result or the big thing that got us to that point. And I think once we learn to do that, it will change everything. And then most importantly, understand that, you know, you can't win as far as winning a tournament or winning or getting the good news. You can't win all the time because somebody else has to win. Like, it doesn't even happen on the PGA Tour. No one wins every tournament. You're not always going to win in life. The big thing that makes you a human being is how do you lose?
That's right.
You know, and I tell kids, the number one thing I tell kids, because it's so taboo for a kid to get pissed off. You know, everybody gets mad, like, oh, he's got an attitude. I tell kids all the time, I look at him, I say, dude, there's nothing wrong with being pissed off. You're pissed off? And I laugh at him. I say, good, I'm glad you're pissed off. Well, why are you glad? I was like, because I want you to be pissed off enough to make a change. Don't just go in your room and sulk. Don't go throw your clubs. Don't go throw them on the ground and all this other stuff and have a salty attitude. Be pissed off enough in your performance where after this round is over, you're going to go take your butt to the range and you're going to go hit balls till your hands bleed, or you're going to go putt balls till you make 36 footers in a row, or whatever the case may be. Don't be pissed off enough to go put the work in. Don't be mad when someone else wins. Don't be salty when someone else wins because they put the work in. You go and you put the same amount of work or more work than they put in so that you're not in that position. And that's it.
I hear you, man. And, you know, it's funny that the piggyback off of that, because that was well said. I like to listen to a lot of Eric Thomas's motivational stuff along with Jocko Willink and a couple other guys that in that bracket. But one of Eric Thomas's statements is, you know, don't quit because you're in pain, to get a reward from it. And,
yeah,
you know, I think that really, that resonates with me in a bunch of different ways, but I think it can resonate with a lot of kids too, because it seems really easy to walk away when you're hurting, you're down, or you know, something didn't go your way, your girlfriend broke up with you, whatever. You know, get a reward for the effort you've put in. Don't just hang it up, because I mean, I quit lacrosse what I felt like was maybe early to focus on golf and make that kind of my primary sport. And I mean, I look back and went, man, I could have quit playing lacrosse. I really wish I didn't give it up just because I was a little undersized and was getting beat around by kids, you know, 6 inches taller than me and 50 pounds heavier. I mean, I still ain't that big, but you know, it's just one of those things that, like, it's so easy to quit, but once you know, like I tell a lot of my kids when they're feeling down in the tournament, you know, didn't go the way, I said, sleep it off. And if you wake up the next day wanting to hit golf balls, go do it. You know, and if the urge is there, then you still got the drive. You still have the want. And just because one bad day got in your way, doesn't mean you got to quit.
You know, I'll be 100% honest with you. The way how I view it is so much different. My view is, in life, or my belief, in life we are given a group, or a, let's call it a catalog of things that we can do. And God gives us these amazing blessings and abilities. And if you quit on those, then you quit on God. And are you really willing to do that? Because all of us have something amazing that we can give and we can bring to this world. And are you really, really willing to quit on God? And that's the way I look at it all. I mean, you know, just because you don't win the first time, or you spend your whole life losing. You know, James Harrison is a great example. He got cut from every team possible and then became one of the best linebackers alive, just straight monster. but that was his road. Everybody's road is not supposed to be easy. And 9 times out of 10, when your road has more bumps and twists and turns, that just means there's something even greater for you if you just hang on. And it doesn't mean that you're going to make it to the NFL. That doesn't mean you're going to make it to the PGA Tour. But what is wrong with being a great family guy? What's wrong, or a great family woman? What's wrong with being an effective leader in your community? What's wrong with being someone where you can make a difference in other people's lives? And yeah, you may not get on TV, you may not be on SportsCenter, you may not be the person who has the Bentley or the Maserati or the Lambo, but does that mean that you are any less important than anyone else because you're making change, you're bringing people hope? God, no.
Man, that is a higher level of thinking, sir. You are on an enlightened scale, I'll tell you that. You talk about how you've interacted with a lot of kids and you're a motivational speaker, and looking at your resume on your website, you've been very involved with youth golf and Boys and Girls Club of America. Talk to us a little bit about what you do, not on the driving range, hitting 400-yard bombs, that you're doing to grow the game. And then obviously at the end of the championship, you're giving part of your earnings away for scholarships back to your, you said, Pine Hill, Florida. So, tell us about what you're doing there to help grow the game and help support the juniors and the youth of the next generation.
So as far as growing the game, I'm actually going to do a motivational speaking tour, trying to partner with a few major sponsors on that, and hopefully we'll be able to pull that out this year, where I'll go around and do like a 12-city stop, and do two locations per city, kind of like a north and a south thing, get all of these wonderful these different summer camps that they have going around, and get it where they say, hey, we're going to be here, bring your kids here, and get groups that have 1,000 kids, 500 kids, and do a clinic and hang out with the kids for the day and high five, and we just have a blast. That's really what I want to do as far as growing the game, and let kids know, hey, you can play this wonderful game. You don't have to be a pro, but you can learn so many lessons in life through this game if you just stick with it, if you just, dare to be different. As far as the stuff that's going on where I grew up, it has absolutely nothing to do with golf. I grew up in the hood. There are no golf courses where I am. It's not the best area in the world. And I don't say that with pride, like, oh, man, I'm from a rough area. Yeah. No, I really say it more out of that stance of, I've always been a person who wants to see my people excel. It's funny. We always, everybody's afraid to talk about race. It's like the most taboo thing out there, but it's something really big now. And I think the reason why it's so big is because people are afraid to have the conversation. But where I grew up, there are a lot of kids who just, their parents are working 2, 3, 4 jobs trying to make ends meet because corporations are afraid of, having to provide health care for people. So they've changed what working full time really is, and they've been able to get some cuts through the government, and people are having to work 28 hours rather than 36, which would be full time, or 32, which is full time, to cut them from getting benefits. So now they have to change their time, and they're struggling between 2 and 3 jobs just to make ends meet, and they still don't have any health care and things of that nature. And what happens is you get some kids who are doing whatever. They may be unsupervised. They may not understand the importance of education. One of the big things in the area I grew up in is everybody's like, oh, man, yeah, he's got to run. He's got to be a great football player because this is how we're going to get a scholarship. Or he's got to be a great basketball player. This is how we're going to get a scholarship. And to me, that's the dumbest thing alive, because as an athlete, even as a world champion, I tell people all the time, you don't want to be an athlete. It's so much easier to be a great student. But you can get a scholarship, an academic scholarship, far easier than you can get an athletic scholarship. And everybody has the opportunity to do it. They just have to apply themselves. And I understand that's not everybody's road. I get that. But they're there. And what we decided to do, my family is not really big on Mother's Day, Father's Day, and things like that. We've never celebrated them. We don't celebrate Christmas in the traditional manner. We don't ever remember getting gifts. Because my mom's statement was, so it's Jesus's birthday, but you're supposed to get gifts. Now tell me how that works. And I was like, oh, she's got a good point on that. She's like, yeah, so you're so important now. She's like, you're so important now. You're getting gifts on somebody else's birthday, right? But yeah, not. I guess I won't ask for anything. Forget the fact all my friends are getting it, but whatever. So, but you know, when you get to a certain point of life, there's nothing else to do. There's nothing. There's no more stuff you can buy. So what I decided to do with my parents was, while they were alive, I was going to dedicate a scholarship in their name because I think that legacy is important. And what my real belief was, you know, you look at scholarships, especially where I grew up, I had a 3.85 GPA. So I had tons of offers. But my real friends were knuckleheads. So, you know, after 2 years of school, they were like, oh, man, I don't have anywhere to go. Life's not going to produce anything for me. So who cares? And they just kept messing up and they kept going down a downward spiral. And then eventually they got their head on straight, but it was so late, so much time that had been gone by. And what we decided to do was do a scholarship that's literally based on what people do the last three semesters of their high school career. And because the belief is everybody needs a second chance. Everybody needs a reason to fight. They need to understand that every day that you're alive, every day that you're breathing is an opportunity to effectively make change. And if we can get kids to understand that, yeah, I know you're not going to have a 4.0. Maybe you had a 1.6 or a 2.0 your first 2 years, and then you came back and just totally smashed it up and you went 4.0 or something like that at the end of your high school career. Well, you're not going to get a scholarship. I can almost guarantee you that. But you may get a look from a college that says, man, there's something different about this kid. So we'll admit them. And then what are they going to say? Well, I don't have a way of paying for it. I don't have any help. Or even if I take loans, I'm still not going to have any money just to survive. So the chances of them being successful are really, really slim. And people don't think about it, but you have all these kids who have 3.5s and higher, and they go to college. But what about the kids who don't have those grades? They're still going to be members of society in some way. And do you want a person who has the feeling that they have nothing to lose really walking around society? You don't. You want everybody to feel like they have a worth, because the most dangerous thing on this earth is the man and or the woman who feels like they have nothing to lose. That person will kill you. That person will hurt you. That person will do things without any regard for anyone else and what their actions can do to affect people's lives, good or bad. They will not care. So this scholarship is really geared to give people hope, to give people a second chance, to keep people fighting, and hopefully put some people out there where they understand that they have worth and they can be somebody who is a product, a good product towards society.
Man, that is, you know, I don't know how to address that, because that was so powerful. And you're so gracious to think, you know, more than what that money could have done for yourself, but how it can go to help others. I mean, that's just, I mean, I feel like I need to go start my own foundation here, because I feel like I'm not
enough. No, man, dude, I'll be honest with you. You know, everybody does their own things in their own way. And for me, I remember that must have been Saturday night after the first round, I was sleeping and it woke me up. And it was like, this is what you're going to do with the money. You're going to give X amount to your church. You're going to give X amount to the schools, and it's more than 10%, but this is what you're going to do. And it had me so messed up that I literally had to write it down on a piece of paper and stick it in my golf bag. And it was in my golf bag the entire tournament. Man, like, it was that sick. Cause everybody always talks about having a goal and not writing them down and how you can't achieve a goal unless you write it down. And I couldn't go. I literally was just tossing and turning. I was like, all right, I got it, God. I got to get up and write this thing down. I understand what you're telling me. I literally wrote it down, stuck it in my golf bag, fell back asleep like I hadn't even woken up. I remember waking up, I was like, did I wake up in the middle of the night, unzip my golf bag where I put my gloves and stuff, and there was a piece of paper sitting right there. I said, all right, that's cool. I mean, yeah. Sometimes you're called to do something bigger, man, and that's not everybody's calling, though. Yeah. That's the beauty of it all. Everybody has a different calling, so people shouldn't feel bad, like, oh, man, Maurice is doing this, and I'm not. No, that's not your job. That's not your place. That's not, you know how everybody always talks about staying in your lane? Stay in your lane. You do what you're supposed to do to the best of your ability, and I'll do what I'm supposed to do to the best of my ability. And if everybody does that, then the world becomes a better place. But the problem is when people get outside their lane, they start trying to do other people's job. You know, I'm not going to go out there and start a podcast. Why? That's my job. That's not what I do. Yeah, I'll go on them when people ask me for them, but that's not what I do.
Yeah. No, I mean, you're absolutely right. That's kind of how I came into my niche, was that I just, you know, I was very fortunate where I was working at the time. I was able to develop a pretty successful junior program. And, you know, 5 years later, I become known as, you know, one of the junior coaches that everybody, you know, wants to seek out. And to me, it started out as like, well, I can teach kids. I mean, that's not too bad. The next, you know, I'm having a lot of fun. I'm starting to watch some of my kids win tournaments, and I'm starting to see how different things evolve, and, you know, and as far as they are, their maturity and who they are as a person, and, you know, how I've played some part in it along the way in occasion. And it's just unbelievable when you have the opportunity to work with kids, because I feel like, one, they're like the truth seekers. I mean, I'm sitting here at 29 years old, and some of them are telling me I'm 40. I'm like, okay, I need to take better care of my skin, I guess. but, you know, they're just so much fun to interact with. And I think you're right in the sense that if you can find what you're good at, have the desire to be the best version of yourself doing that mission, then who knows what ground's going to get laid in front of you that you can follow. And I think the things that you're doing are, just really special. And that's part of the reason why, when, you know, we connected through Instagram, when I sent that message, I'm like, hey man, this guy seems to be really, really involved with, you know, youth and junior golf and things like that. I want to make sure that, you know, if he has something to say, I want to make sure he gets on here and say it. And man, I can't thank you for your time. I hope you continue to enjoy what you do best at pounding a golf ball 400 yards plus, and good luck with the foundation. Is there anything else that you want to share with the podcast listeners that you want to get off your chest or tell everybody that, you know, as a motivational speaker that can inspire them to be the best version that they can be?
The words that I live by are famously from Notorious B.I.G. Stay far from timid. Make moves only when your heart's in it. Live the phrase, sky's the limit. That's it, bro.
That is a great quote. And you know I got to ask it. I know you're tired, but man, I got to hear it. Can I get a player?
I will never, ever, ever do it again. That one was the last one.
That's fine.
Never happen again. I promise you. It'll never. It's crazy because I got a text from my mom afterwards. She said, the Ric Flair is done. I said, yeah.
Mom's always right, man.
Mom's always right, baby.
Dude, I just had to ask, man. I loved it. You are a outstanding individual. And if there's anything that I can do to help you along the way, please, you have my contact info. Holler at me if you need anything that I could do as another PGA professional to help you out with your initiatives. I'd be glad to help. Again, I thank you for your time. I hope you get some sleep and you keep, you know, traveling this journey that you're doing so well at, my friend.
Hey, I appreciate it. Let's keep the lines of communication open, man. Anytime you need something, you need a clinic or exhibition, give me a shout, man. We'll figure out a way to make it work.
Absolutely. Will do, sir. Have yourself a great night and enjoy your weekend.
All right. Thanks a lot. You do the same.
All right. Take care.
All right.
Well, I don't know about you, but that was one of the most fun podcasts I've done yet. He is just an inspiring individual that I think brings an unparalleled amount of enthusiasm and motivation to just everybody. I don't think it's just to golfers. So I think there's plenty of golden nuggets in this podcast that you can take away that will better you going forward and things to live by as you try and achieve your goals in life and in the game of golf. So with that, I don't have much else to say because he's said it so well for me today. And I hope you've enjoyed the podcast and thank you for tuning in. As always, if you've enjoyed listening to the podcast, please subscribe, like it, and write a review for us if you would. And if you want to connect on social media, the podcast Facebook page is Junior Golf Blueprint, or you can follow me at Matt Walter PGA and we can get connected. If you have a story to tell or you know somebody that's doing big things in the game of golf or for juniors, go ahead and get in touch with me through social media or through my email, mattwaltergolf@gmail.com, and we'll get you on the podcast so you can share what you're doing to help better the game of golf. So until then, have a great day.